Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognize, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. Making positive choices when cooking and eating is something most of us strive for. So I'm delighted to say that for the month of December, I've teamed up with an Irish family-run company whose ethos is exactly that. I've been a big fan of Dr. Coy's health foods for years now. I use their stevia in my morning coffee every day, and their delicious chocolate is also full of nutritional benefits and gives you energy without the sugar crash. And to celebrate our partnership, they're offering 25% off their entire range of nutritional products. Simply go to their website, drcoys.ie, and use the code SHEILA25. This week, I chat to university lecturer, PhD student, radio presenter and author, Brian Penny.
But what I would say, if you're trying to give up and you're having these cravings, I think it's a great tool in addiction circles. It was part of my PhD. It's part of a course called Mindfulness-Based Relapse Prevention. And there's an idea in it that a craving is a very strange energy in the body, but a craving only lasts about 60 to 90 minutes, 90 seconds. That's all a craving actually lasts.
That's short.
Yeah, it's a short time. And you could have a craving and say, I'd love a drink, but you could be hungry, you could be thirsty, you could be craving something else. But to get over that craving, there's a great mindfulness practice that's called surfing the urge. So literally think of that craving like a wave coming into the shore, and instead of just sort of giving into it, you just picture yourself surfing that urge and let it come in and surf the wave, ride the wave all the way into shore. And when that comes in, that craving will be gone.
The 8th of October 2013 was Brian's first day clean after 15 years of chronic heroin addiction. And since that day, he has radically turned his life around. Now at 42, life is good. This year, he released his compelling memoir, Bonus Time, and he also found love for the very first time in his life. During our chat, he talks about feeling anxious from an early age, his upbringing, and of course, his heroin addiction. But we also talk about what he's learned through years of study and self-reflection. We talk about the power of self-talk, the importance of routine, practicing gratitude, mindfulness, and most of all, connection. I learned so much from Brian during this conversation, and I hope you find it as beneficial as I did. I want to start with you as a child, you know, what kind of kid you were, because I know being anxious was something that played its part in your life.
Yeah, it played such a huge role in my life, Sheila, and it really stems from being an infant for me. So I came into the world with a condition known as intestinal malrotation, and in lay terms, basically what that was my intestines were twisted in my guts. So when I was born, for the first couple of weeks when I was born, I was just like vomiting all the time. There was no nutrients getting into my body. So I was misdiagnosed a few times. A couple of weeks later, after I was born, they recognised they made a huge mistake. They were telling me, "Mom, it's colic, it's colic, it's colic." It wasn't. And I lost half my birth weight. So it was like a big panic, rush to Harcourt Street Hospital at the time, police escort. Like, it was crazy stuff, like near death experience, nearly, in fairness, after only being born. And what many people don't know, and this is the crazy thing, that it was only in 1985 did the medical practice realise that infants experience pain like normal human beings. So before that, infants went under had operations without a general anaesthetic. So I actually had, it's crazy, it's absolutely insane. So I only done research on this when I wrote my book and I found out about this. And from a psychological perspective, like, I've studied psychology, I've gone into the depths of this stuff, and I found I've literally been conditioned to view the world as a painful place. So for the first year of my life, there was complications from the surgery, and I was just experiencing pain. I cried for the first year of my life. So I would have just been in flight mode and just like sort of associating the world with danger and pain. And I think that just primed me for a life of anxiety. And whether I would have been, like, as I grew up and got a bit older, I was just I worried about everything. I was compulsively thinking. I was always nervous and agitated and restless. And I think it was primed through that. I think that was a big feature of that. And it just really carried through to my childhood.
So in terms of that experience, so you had an operation. And yeah, that you were completely lucid for it as a young baby.
So based on neurological evidence, weak neurological evidence from the 1940s, based on pinpricking evidence, they realised that they didn't need to give kids a general anaesthetic. So you did give you a muscle relaxant. Right. So I don't know whether I was asleep or not, what way that worked. But I think I was just sort of a muscle relaxant to stop me squirming. And then it would have been given the operation, a full operation without a general anaesthetic. So I think I would have been awake to an extent. Yeah, it's crazy.
Crazy. And it sounds so barbaric to us now.
Yeah.
But that's not long ago when you think about it.
It's not long ago. It was only in 1985. I forget the woman's name. And she found out that her child had open heart surgery without a general anaesthetic. And there was a big outcry. Gosh. And when the medical practice looked into it, they were like, "Oh my God, what have we been doing for the last few years?" It was just this big shift in perspective on that. They realised what they were doing was based on weak evidence from many years ago. And he just changed the shift completely. There was a few other moments in my life that caused trauma, I think, or hurt. I think hurt is the better way of talking about it. Like, my first memory is this young girl says to me, "Do you remember bags of Dib Dab, the fizz?"
Yeah.
She says, "Do you want some Dib Dab?" I was in the field, across my house. I think it was 3 or 4 at the time, my first memory. Yeah. And I put my hand in the bag and there was bees in the bag. There was bees in the bag. That's my first memory in life. So like, I had these little mini traumas throughout my life. And then another big one was, we moved to Canada when I was 5 years of age. Yeah. And we were supposed to be going to Australia, the whole family. There was something happened with restrictions to Australia, so we changed shift and the whole family's going to go to Canada instead. But my mum was pregnant with my brother James, and she had to stay back. So I was only 5 at the time. We moved over without my mum, so I wasn't with my mum for 4 months. And then when she arrived with a new baby. So I think that had a big impact on my life as well.
Yeah.
And then there was the alcohol as well. So I always say I come from a loving family, and I really do. I have great relationships with my family now, but it was an alcoholic background. And I would say the biggest memory of my life and the biggest cause of anxiety in my life, besides the earlier trauma, is just from the ages of 6 to 10 years of age in Blanchardstown in Dublin. I just remember Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, looking out through the bedroom curtains, waiting for my mum and dad to come home, drunk from the pub because they'd be drink driving. And I think primed by my anxiety and this overthinking mind, I'd be very analytical as well. I'm always thinking, and that's the way I always was. And I was just worrying about everything, and I would just be obsessed. I'd start my window watches, I'd say, from about 10 o'clock. And I remember every car that drove down the road, I'd jump up to the window, it's this them, like the hopes building, this could be them, this could be them. The car would drive past, I'd sit back down to bed. And that was like huge memories that I have of growing up in childhood. And I just think that a multitude of these different things just sort of primed me for a life anxiety, as I like to say. And That's when I found drugs. Like, I've been recently talking to a psychologist, and we're developing a course around addiction recovery, The Secrets of Addiction Recovery, it's called. And she basically thinks, like, I hadn't got a chance. As soon as I tried drugs, like, that was going to give me the relief, the warm blanket that just wrapped around me and gave me that relief away from that. So it really just set the stage for a life of addiction for me.
Did you feel like that was absent growing up? Because I know you speak extremely fondly about your parents and your siblings, and I know that they have been a huge help in the process of writing your book.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, with all the other, as you said, being separated from your mum for the period of those few months when you travelled to Canada, the fact that alcohol played such a big part, were you craving just safety, connection?
Yeah, 100%. And there's a great line by Johan Hari: sobriety is not the opposite of addiction, connection is. I think awareness is a big piece of that as well. And although I come from a very, very loving family, love wasn't showed in an affectionate way either. So I think that was something missing from your life as well. Like, we didn't hug each other. We don't hug each other in our family. And now when I know people, now I'm a big hugger. I didn't know that up until recently, you know. And so that wasn't in the family. But I was always fed. There was always food on the table. We were always brought on holidays. We knew the love was there, but I craved connection and I craved affection. And I suppose parenting skills, my parents done the best with the tools we were given, but they left school at 13, 14 years of age. So there wasn't really, like, I would have been good in school and stuff like that. And I always wanted to achieve. That was a big thing in my life, to achieve. And I was never really given the structures to help me build that as well. So I think that was something missing from my life as well.
And the fact that you are obviously so accomplished now in adulthood, and you've gone on to achieve, what you've done is mind-boggling, to be honest. It's amazing. But was that recognised when you were a kid? Did they see that in you? Okay, you know what? Brian is he's got something.
It's funny you say that. So my mom would have her own stuff. Like, my mom's amazing, but she'd have her own stuff as well. And one of the things that she always passed onto us would have been, not in a good way, would have been, stay in the middle. Don't be too good, don't be too bad, so you don't get recognised, and there won't be bullying, there won't be any of that kind of thing. So if you stay in the middle, you'll be okay. So I was pretty good. I was pretty good in school. I'd be good at football, but my mom would never push me forward, because that would be me putting myself marking myself to be targeted by other people, I suppose. And one of my brothers was bullied as well. I never was. But so she always says stay in the middle. And my sister would have struggled with that as well. Like, it'd be like, she was a great Irish dancer, but she wouldn't have been pushed to the level she could have gone. She could have gone, like, right to the very top. And it's funny. I remember having an argument with my mum someday, and says, "It won't be capable of that. Don't be aiming too high." And I remember getting teary. It was the only time I remember crying in front of my mum when I was younger. And I remember saying, "Don't you put your stuff on me. I can be whatever I want to be." Now, I ended up being a heroin addict for a long time, so I didn't really fulfill that journey. But that was always there, that want to fulfill some kind of, to do well in life. That drive was always there.
Yeah. So the drive was always there, but unfortunately life took you down a different path for a period of years.
Yeah.
So was alcohol kind of a stepping stone to heavier, stronger drugs?
No, I always say it was part of it, but I always say cigarettes were the stepping stone for me.
Okay.
So I was obsessed with football. For me, like, I was good in school and stuff like that, but for me, it was all about, I wanted to be a footballer. I was good at football. I was never going to make it as a professional footballer. In retrospect, I wasn't that good, but I was a good footballer. It was talk of me going to England and stuff like that. And I got a knee injury at 14 years of age because all my friends were starting to smoke cigarettes and mess around with hash and stuff like that. And I was saying, there's no way would I put a cigarette in my body, damage my football career or whatever. But I remember being injured for a few months, and we were up on top of the football dressing rooms of all things, ironically. And my friend Alan was saying, oh, the head buzz you get off that. And I must have been getting interested in drugs. That's the age, maybe, especially in the area where I grew up. Great area, but drug riddled area as well, I suppose, back then especially. And I must have been getting curious about drugs, and I was like, a head buzz. And that piqued my interest. And I remember taking the first puff of my cigarette on top of the dressing rooms, and I remember the buzz I got from that was a big Samson, big dirty roll-up Samson tobacco roll-up, and the head buzz I got from that. And I loved that little head buzz that I got from that. And I was starting to then start smoking cigarettes. Soon enough, I was taking puffs of joints and stuff like that. Within a few months, I was messing around with tablets, acid, over the next year or two, petrol. We used to sniff a lot of petrol then as well. alcohol, and it really just, alcohol was a part of it, but it was really just a mix of everything. It was really just a mix of everything, up until the age of 16, just messing around with all alcohol and different drugs.
So it happened quickly, like?
Yeah, pretty quickly, yeah.
So would you kind of just try anything? Was there ever a voice in your head going, maybe not?
No, it's crazy. And there was a priest when I went to a treatment center. Finally, when I got there in the end, there was a priest at the treatment center, and I never forget. He said that some people have, I wouldn't do that, and they would have that a cocaine. Oh, wouldn't do class A drugs, or I wouldn't take a tablet and do weed. They'll just drink and smoke hash. Some people will do coke, but wouldn't do heroin. I never had that even when it came to injecting heroin. Like, I have a morbid fear of needles still to this day, but that was the only thing that held me back from injecting heroin, but I still got there in the end. So I never really had that don't do that, which is really strange. It was like this idea that I was bulletproof, which we obviously aren't, but it was just this idea that I'd be okay no matter what, which obviously wasn't the case.
Is that an age thing as well, though? Because sometimes when we're in those years, and particularly, I suppose, for men, for boys, you know, there is that feeling of, we can do anything, take on the world.
Yeah, I've read about this. It's supposed to be an evolutionary perspective as well. It's like it pushes people forward and it helps it. Like, if you want to take over clans, because we're still working off the same biological machinery that served us thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
Evolution doesn't know we have smartphones and we're living in cities and stuff like that. So that drive is still there to take risks and be bold and be brave and dare greatly. And I think that was part of it as well.
Right. So then you go down the heroin route, and that, unfortunately, is a really long road. I mean, 15 years of it.
Yeah.
And you've spoken about it in the book, and that I've heard you before speak about that first time and feeling this warmth.
Yeah. When I think of heroin, like, now, it's like I lost a relationship. It was like a marriage. It was like a relationship. That was the connection I had with life. It was a false sense of connection.
Mm.
But like, I dedicate a whole chapter in that book to my first night down heroin. And the name of the chapter is Fallen in Love.
Love, yeah.
So you talk about connection. And I'll never forget it. That's how I describe it. It was like a warm, soft blanket just wrapping around my soul, taking all of my pain away. It was like the voice went quiet, the bodily sensations, the feelings. Like, I always struggled with bodily sensations, which I think were it triggered from the earlier trauma that I had. Mm. Like, it's only in the last few years I've been comfortable with my own heartbeat and my own pulse. There were struggles that I had, obviously, that came through with earlier traumas.
Yeah.
But when I took heroin, it was just like it took all of that away. It was like, there's a great song by Pink Floyd that describes it. They call it Comfortably Numb.
Mm.
But it was just this comfortably numb feeling. All of the pain was gone away. All of the worries were gone away. And everything felt okay. And I remember it was like a voice that night saying, like, keep me close and I'll look after you. And even though I wasn't addicted from, like, a lot of people think you get addicted from heroin the first time, like, I was mentally addicted from that very first time, but it took me a while. Like, I thought I was too smart for heroin. I thought I was too clever for heroin. So it took me a while before I got to grips with me and I became a daily heroin addict. But it dug its claws in from that very first night. So for me, I was able to not be all consumed by heroin. And it had me in its claws. It had me in its grips early on. But I was able to not let it consume me as long as I could keep anxiety at bay. And from the ages of 17, that's when I first took heroin, up until the age of 20, I was doing it once a week, once every 2 weeks, playing around with it. I was probably never going to escape it in the end, looking back now. But when I was 20, I had my first panic attack. And my panic attack, which is very dangerous, like, panic attack is a panic attack. I used to say my anxiety, like, I owned anxiety, which was very, my sense of self was built within that, which is dangerous in itself. But when I had that panic attack, it was like I thought I was going to die. Like, the dread of a panic attack, it's one of the most fearsome experiences you can go through. And it sort of ramped up my anxiety levels by 10. It was like when after the panic attack, me general anxiety was at a much higher level, much, much higher level. And I remember I wasn't able to work. I had a few debts at the time. I was in my job about 3 years and I had a few debts because of loans, credit cards, MBNA, if you remember them back at the time.
Yeah.
Dishing out gold cards.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was in work, I couldn't actually work on the computer. I was doing graphics at the time and I was trying to click the button and I'd be shaking my hands and the anxiety was just all consuming. I couldn't do my job. And I remember going to my GP and he gave me Anxicam. I think they were Valium at the time. and he says take them, and he got rid of the anxiety and I could go to work. And I was messing around, heroin was digging its claws in a little bit more, and I remember dealing some of the tablets with a bag of heroin one of the Friday nights, and it gave me an extra great buzz, taking the anxiety away. And I went to my doctor the following week and I said to him, can I get another box of Valium? And he says, oh no, that's just a short term fix. And I remember getting really angry with him, saying, I need them, I can't operate in the world. And he says, but he gave me a book, I can't even remember what the book was, he gave me a book to read. And I says, I don't need a book, I need drugs. Like, and I remember walking out of that GP and I rationalised and justified my way into it. He is making me do heroin, which is was an absolute farce.
Yeah, well,
but I was able to justify it that way. Right, the world is telling me I have to do heroin. And that's I was doing it a lot more then. I was starting to do it 2 or 3 times a week and I was starting to get addicted and stuff like that. And it had me pretty soon after that.
Were you always doing it on your own or did you ever do it with other people?
It was me and my best friend. I won't say his name. Sure. Barry's his name in the book. It was crazy. A little offshoot story of that. I met him last week for the first time in a couple of years out in Blanchardstown Centre. And he's still, unfortunately, he's still on the streets. So he's still going through a bad way. But we had the best laugh. We had such good fun. We're going to meet up again soon. But he went into the off-license. I shouldn't be laughing about this, but he went into the off-license at one stage to grab it, to get smokes, he said. But he actually tried to rob 6 cans of Druids Glen, while he was in there, the security. I'm like, I could have gotten arrested, you know what I mean? The world I'm in now. And then the following night, I'm in Trinity College, only 100 yards down the street. Having a chat with the president of Trinity College on Fergal Nocton, and I'm like, the difference in those 2 nights of where I've come from.
Is it like sliding doors for you?
Oh, it was an incredible thing. Terrible for my friend.
But you must be inspiring for him. Does he look at you and go, or does he ever say, you know, can I do what you've done?
Right, so he doesn't. He thinks he's so deep now. He is. So we're looking into this at the moment, and he wants to have a chat. And I'm blown away by this because I didn't think it was going to happen.
Right.
So when we were having a chat that night, he actually said to me, "says Don't put me into your algorithms. You will blow up your computers if you put my details in there." And he says, "You're not. What do you say? You're not only an agent. You're an agent. If you think you can get me, if you think you can fix me." But a seed was planted, and we're going to hook up again and have a chat again. Now, obviously, he hasn't got a phone and stuff like that. It's hard to make contact, so we make contact through Facebook, but I'm hopeful for the first time in years that we could go somewhere with that.
I hope Jesus, that would be, I'm sure you're getting such satisfaction from the work you're doing now in terms of helping people, sharing your story, sharing your skills with people. But if something positive was to happen there, that would be phenomenal.
It would. To see the actions, to see the fruits coming in, it's great. It's really great, yeah.
Would you have ever thought back then that you'd be where you're at now? Like, if somebody had showed you like a crystal ball of your life now, running courses, writing your book, you know, being on stage in front of people, talking, sharing your story, what would you have made of that?
The gratitude is the key piece. I'm going off a little bit off topic here, but even being here today, I'm like going into me, Sheila, we're going to be on this podcast. I'm just really grateful for every single day, every single event. And I think that's a key piece as well. But I never would have imagined I would have done that. Like, so I had, it was the big shift in perspective for me was when I had a seizure back in 2013. It was a big shift in perspective for me and I thought it was brain damaged. And when I was in detox, I remember thinking, maybe I can go back to college. It was just like a little whisper in my head. Maybe I can back to college. Wouldn't that be amazing? I said, who do you think you are? You couldn't go back to college. And I remember Dr. Johanna Ivers came in to do a brain study and I was part of a brain scan. It's incredible. I actually got a brain scan in the Institute of Neuroscience recently and the changes in my brain over time are incredible. That's a whole other story. But I was sort of answering questions that was the next question that Johanna should have asked. And she turned around to me and says, do you know what, Brian? Says, you have a very sharp mind. And that was like, I was like, maybe I'm not brain damaged. Maybe I can go back to college. And that was like the little spark that just sparked things off. Now, I've since gone on, I'm teaching with Johanna in Trinity College now, which is crazy. And that's how she gave me Rick Hansen's book, Buddha's Brain. And now he's on my radio show next week. So it's the way the world comes around in circles. But it was all about, it looks like I made these big, huge strides. But for me, it was lots and lots of baby steps, but showing up every single day. But lots and lots and lots of baby steps. And there's an element of belief as well. There is a part of that is this belief, it's self-deception. Like, my book isn't about addiction, it's about self-deception. I could tell myself any lie and cross any boundary, take any action by telling myself a lie and believing it. That's what I was the master at. I was a black belt in self-deception. And I didn't believe I was that bad. I didn't believe I was a real addict. And this is a real trend throughout the book. And I think because I didn't believe that, I wasn't dealing with these horrific pangs of shame and remorse, because I didn't actually realise I was there. I didn't feel them emotions at the time. So I think when I got out of addiction, I think there was an element of, you can go on and do anything here. There was this like self-belief, anything is possible here, give it a chance. Because it was like, I was given a second chance at life. Like, that, the name of the book is Bonus Time. I was given a second chance. Yeah. So it was like, why not just go out and just give it a shot and not care and see what happens? And I think that boldness really, really helped me. And when I start seeing rewards of that, it just that set the tone. Then from behavioral psychology, will tell you that if you're rewarded for behavior, you're going to do it more. So my boldness was being rewarded, and I just started getting bolder and bolder and bolder and taking other steps. And I think people like a bit of boldness as well. And it's, some people in Ireland call it notions, but here I have big notions too, so you know,
I think we need to embrace notions.
We do
because as Irish people, I think we're, that's what, you know, we say it, but actually, and it's fun, and it's, but slagging is great and it's healthy and all the rest, but we should all have notions about ourselves, because actually the majority of us don't have enough notions about ourselves, and we keep ourselves down and we don't actually believe that we are capable of the things that we are capable of. Yeah. I mean, I'm only starting to tap into it, because I have a very strong, I think a lot of us have a strong self-critic that lives inside us.
Yeah.
And I have to have constant conversations with that voice, but I'm slightly getting better. I feel like some days it's like 5 steps forward, 2 back, you know, vice versa. But I'm delighted you've notions about yourself. Bring on the notions.
Bring on the notions. Yeah. There's a thing. There's a thing they say, like, BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. And I says, I have big, hairy, audacious notions. Yeah. Just go for it. Just absolutely go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to wrap up those years of addiction and you know where you're at now, but that period of I suppose waking up and going, nah, this is not for me anymore, I want to stop. That was a very, very long and tough road.
It was a tremendously tough road. And there was never really a decision, I want to stop. It was more of a need. So, like, for
anyone... you didn't want to stop.
I didn't want to stop. Right. I didn't think I could stop. My story, I had a the narrative in my life was, I cannot cope, anxiety, I need heroin to survive. The narrative today is very different. It's around notions and stuff like that. But that was the narrative that drove my life. I'm obsessed with language and emotions and how it drives our actions and our feelings. So that's a lot of my studies go into that as well. And that was my story. Now, I was a very functional addict through a lot of my life as well. So I had a job for many of them years. Now, I've talked to people since, I wasn't functional at all, but I was holding down a job for certain reasons as well. It gets a bit complex how I did that. But basically, when I lost my job, I lost my health, I lost my mind, I went into a form of psychosis as well, I lost everything. And I had no choice. And I says, right, it's time to sink or swim, I'm going to have to get clean to an extent, go into a treatment facility. But I still didn't think I could cope with anxiety without some kind of drugs. So I remember thinking, right, I'll have to get off heroin and stuff, but I'll have to do tablets, I'll need something, I need my crutch. So I went to get into a detox facility, and I was told 8 weeks to get into a detox facility that'll wean me off the benzos and all Valium and drugs like that. And I says, oh, I need to do this now, I can't wait 8 weeks. And he says, well, you can go into the Lantern, which is a methadone clinic, but you have to be clean of all drugs except methadone. And I says, right, but there was a lot of benzos in my system, benzodiazepine, and they would have taken 4 weeks to come out of my system, 3 weeks. So I says, right, I'm going to do a detox at home on them. And I was warned not to, but I'd done it anyway. And I described this is the prologue of the book, actually. It's probably, I think, the pivotal moment of my life. So 2 nights into that home detox was not only the most painful night of my life, it was the most important night of my life. And I woke up and me sitting around the floor, blood everywhere. And I had actually had what I was warned could happen, was a grand mal convulsive seizure. So basically every cell in my brain fired at the same time, all the neurons fired at the same time, and all my body convulsed. And I'd actually driven my teeth down the center of my tongue, and that's where the blood was coming from. It was a horrific experience. And I remember my family rallied around me in my time of need after tormenting them for years. Like, they were really strong. They were really there for me at that time. I was rushed to hospital, ambulance job. And I remember sitting in Blanchardstown Hospital, and I was lying on a trolley, and I'll never forget. I just wanted to jump out of my body. Like, the anxiety levels were ramped up to all kinds of levels because I was going through withdrawals as well. And I just wanted to jump out of my own skin. And I was just like emotionally, mentally and physically broken. And I just had to sat up on the trolley, and my eyes just fixated on this fire extinguisher hanging on the wall. And I remember I just had the like tunnel vision, just lost looking at this fire extinguisher. And I remember looking at it saying, that's the colour red. And I says, and that's a fire extinguisher. And I was trying to put the words together, the concepts together, and I couldn't put them together. And I remember saying, that's weird, my brain isn't working right. And I remember looking around the room at other objects in the room, and I couldn't put sentences together. And I remember just thinking, oh my God, your brain damage. That's it, you're actually brain damage. You're game over, you're done. And I remember just sort of sitting back on the trolley, waiting for anxiety and panic just to overwhelm me, like it always has, like something like that would have just overwhelmed me so badly. And I just remember thinking, oh, I'm done, I can't do this anymore, I'm done, I give up, I'm not fighting this anymore, you've literally beat me, I'm done, I can't do this anymore. And it was like this sense of calm came over me. It was like the fight was over, I put up the white flag. And that, I believe, was the moment, the start of the moment that completely transformed my life. It was like the crack in the ego that gave me an opportunity to look at life from a different perspective. I think it was a really critical juncture of my rock bottom, for want of a better word. So that was the moment that started it all off. So I had another 4 weeks. I still had the 4 weeks to come off the benzos. Another couple of seizures, another couple of hospital visits. I didn't even go to bed for that. Then 4 weeks, I just lay on my couch up with my brothers. They looked after me. I remember having to make a phone call at one stage for some reason, an important phone call. I couldn't even squeeze the phone. Like, there was no strength. So I was physically broken. Like, I was literally broken down. So I finally, the benzos came out of my system. I got down to 40 mils of methadone. So I was able to get into the detox facility to get off opiates then as well. And I was on a farm up in Nall, a great memories because it was so life changing for me. But as I got down, weaned myself down to a small amount of methadone, I've heard about mindfulness for the first time. I began reading about books about spirituality and psychology and getting interested in all this stuff, like a self. We have this self and self-talk, awareness, all of these concepts that were so foreign to me. And I was obsessed by them. And I wrote a diary during that time and a lot of stuff in that diary. And when I looked back on it a few years ago, I was like, wow, it was like I was ingraining ideas in my brain, because I live a lot of the ideas that I was reading about at that time, like we need to be unconditioned, we need to be open in life, we need to embrace failure, all of these different things. And when I'll never forget it, on the 8th of October 2013, it was my very, very first day clean, and there was already an energy coming into my life, and it was like a little tune playing in my mind. You might have a life again. That was a big piece for me. You might have a life again. And on my first day clean, I remember walking down to have breakfast that morning. I was up on my own early that morning, and it was like the day was just beckoning me outside. And it was just, the world just seemed so beautiful. It was like just everything had this energy and colour in it. It was like things that were once hollow were just like full of depth. And I've come to realise now I was really sort of pushed into the present moment, because it was a beautiful October Duke's Oak morning. And I remember just sitting on the fence, and there was a cat, Molly, that was at the detox facility, and she crawled up my leg that morning. And I remember just looking at the lush grass and the dewdrops on the grass. They were just like diamonds. And I described it was like nature was literally breathing on my skin. It was one of the best experiences of my life. And that, I believe, was just such a profound shift in perspective that just says, you have a chance again. You can go on and live a life again. And it was that shift through the fire extinguisher experience. But then when I had this experience as well, there was just a huge shift in perspective, which really pushed me on the journey as well. Like, I was fascinated by when I done a meditation a couple of weeks later at another. So after detox, I went to a treatment facility and then another treatment facility, because they still thought I was mad. I was living on my cloud nine saying life is great, and they thought I was a bit crazy. But so they didn't realize the shift I had, I suppose. But I remember doing a mindfulness exercise, and he says, thoughts will come in and thoughts will go out. And I remember having this realization, oh my God, my mind is so quiet. Now, it's not quiet anymore, just in case anyone's listening, it's gone busy again. I'm back in the real world. But my mind went really, really quiet. But I mean, my mind went quiet, it was like anxiety left me. So that was this burning desire to, why did I suffer? Why don't I suffer anymore? How I can share it with others? And what is this relationship between thinking, language, self-talk and emotions? And this is a huge journey I'm on at the moment. Like, I'm all about self-talk, and a lot of my courses are around that as well. But I'm bringing in the neuroscience behind that, my PhD studies. And I just think if we can become more aware of the narrative, the inner critic, as you mentioned earlier on, be more aware of that and change that, we can ultimately change how we feel and change our lives. And I think that's the big message that I'd like to share with people going forward.
Yeah, and I want to get into that, because I'm big into self-talk and the power of the words we use.
Oh yeah.
But It's very interesting to hear you speak about that, that kind of appreciation, that hyper awareness you had, that you can see and smell and hear everything so, yeah. so clearly. I can connect to it in my own way, in the sense that when I got the all clear from cancer, I had that feeling where everything was beautiful
yeah.
and gorgeous. And I kind of describe it like it's the afterglow. But the thing that I kind of struggle with is that it doesn't stay. You got to work at keeping it there.
You got to work at it.
You know,
it. Yeah.
And it's like, because I still remember, though, you know, stepping out of the hospital and getting the news. And honestly, it's like everything was sharper. I could see everything clearer. Yeah. I could hear everything. I could feel everything. There was a kind of soft drizzle, and it felt so refreshing and beautiful. But it was lovely. And I celebrated that. And it was just that overwhelming feeling of gratitude, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always stay. So you gotta work at it, don't you? You have to, and that's where, you know, implementing tools, whatever works for you, is important. Because oftentimes things like phones and whatever distract us from being in the present moment. And I know that's something you're really passionate about. So let's talk about self-talk. Because oftentimes, and I put my hand up as somebody who still, I fall into the hole of knowing things, but maybe not doing.
Yeah.
You know, and then I catch myself speaking to myself in a certain way, and I'm going, like, I know better,
yeah.
but I'm still doing it. I still find myself going into these repeated ways of thinking and speaking. So for you, self-talk has been massive and a massive help in your life, which is why you're so passionate about sharing with others.
Yeah, 100%. And it's nearly, self-talk can just be something simple as certain words that we actually use, like words like, I can't, I must, if only, COVID-19 made me feel that way, he or she made me feel that way. Like, it's very reactive kind of language. You must do that, you have to do that. It's nearly like you're being cornered. Whereas if you're aware of that self-talk, that you're always, other people are making you feel that way, things are making you feel that way, it's like, it's a very passive way, it's a very reactive way of acting in the world. So simple little things like that, I'd like to change, I change myself, I prefer to do that, I choose to do that. So you're the agent of your own destiny. And I think that's really important, just with the smaller words. But it's even things like if you have the stories, we'll get into what stories people have now in a second, but it's really like if you have a victim mentality, a victim story, that things always happen to you. If something happens, you're going to be like, why me? And if you say why me in your head, like that self-talk, it's like, it's a real defeatist attitude. But if you just switch that and say, what can I do about this? It's like all of a sudden the shoulders come up. It's a different way of speaking to yourself. Like, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do? And it's a completely different shift in perspective, and that helps you to act in the world. But I think the stories we tell ourselves are the key piece, like the inner critic, self-doubt, not good enough, all of these kinds of things, can't cope. Mine was, I can't cope, and it left me in addiction for so long. I've flipped that story on its head. My story today is, adversity doesn't stop me, it fuels my ability to thrive. And I nearly fake it until I make it for a certain time. Like, you have to just tell yourself that you're going to be great. But then all of a sudden you start embodying that and you start living it. Like, even when COVID-19 kicked in, the 29th of March, that's when my book came out. I was supposed to be, I was in the final chats of going on the Late Late Show. It looked like I was going to be on the Ryan Tuberty Show. In the same day, Ryan Tuberty's not going to happen. Bookshops are closing, but you can still sell online books. An hour later, no, all the books are trapped in Gill. You can't even sell online books. And I swear to God, Sheila, I actually found myself looking out the window with a big grin on my face saying, wow, even this doesn't bother you. How are you going to use this adversity?
Oh, I love it.
And it was,
really?
It was amazing.
Really?
Really?
You didn't have a moment of bollocks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, there was like in the body, when I was getting told all the news, like I'd feel it in the body.
Poor me,
wallowing, but I caught it.
There's a great
line in Viktor Frankl's book, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is your chance to choose your response. There lies your growth and your freedom. So a lot of the work I do would be around self-observation, like observing me thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations, increasing that space between stimulus and response, observing that self-talk, catching it in its tracks so it doesn't hijack me emotions in the biological way that it does. And when you do that, so I felt it biologically, but the space was bigger. And that's when I smiled and I said, right, what are you going to do about this? And it's actually turned into, like, it was a much bigger win for me to find out I was really living on bonus time. Like, it was, this stuff is real. I'm living my truth. And that was better than selling books or going on the Ryan Tubridy Show. Nothing against any of that, but it was a bigger thing for me internally. So,
and that's a great message for anyone listening as well, because we've been faced with a lot of obstacles this year, and people's careers have changed. A lot of people have been made redundant, or certainly their careers, there's a kind of like pressing pause on it at the moment. So instead of viewing the now and the difficulty as, oh, woe is me, you know, flipping the kind of the language around it is really good.
We all need to be aware of our values as well, like what values you are living. I think that needs to, like, values based decisions are such a crucial part of my life. The self talk is huge, but making values based decisions, and COVID-19 sort of made me reevaluate my values. I'd have a very strong value system. I know what my values are, and be like boldness, accountability, industry, and it's, they were the things pushing me forward, connection, inner peace, all these different things as well. But when COVID-19 came along, I sort of reevaluated my own values, and like things that were elevated to the fore were like connection was huge, and compassion for others within that moment, but then flexibility, that's been the biggest one, because an ability to adapt to a changing situation, we don't know what's going to happen, it's unpredictable, it's unknown, it's uncertain. So if you're going to make decisions based on and have a value system based on prioritizing flexibility, because things could change, it allows you to change within that moment. So if something happens, your self-talk isn't going to be around, oh my god, this happened to me, it says, right, what can I do with this, how can I adapt to this situation, and it could just change your perspective and change your actions then.
I still see you on the late, and probably soon.
I have plans.
Yeah. It's going to happen, isn't it?
With a bit of luck.
I will, of course.
Maybe on the 29th. I says, I wonder if you can do it again a year on, post-COVID launch like that. That'd be nice.
Yeah. I definitely see that happening. They'd be mad not to have you, for God's sake.
Cheers, appreciate that.
No, it's just the truth. So, so there's common kind of things that we say about ourselves. We can be saying things like as simple as, oh, I'm so tired, I'm shattered, I'm can be commentary on how we look a lot of the time. It can be our abilities. So oftentimes I tend to put myself down about my tech ability, because it's never been a strong point of mine. But I'm trying to, if I don't necessarily change the entire structure of the sentence, I'll put in yet at the end. I'm not great at that, and I'll catch myself yet.
Yeah.
So that I'm not, you know, reaffirming this. Yeah. A lack of ability that I might have when it comes to operating, you know, like trying to record stuff from home and different things. And I feel I'm quite, it's just born out of fear, not knowing and feeling a bit vulnerable about, you know, using equipment. And I tend to put myself down. So I'm trying to, it's hard, and I'm working at it, but it's tough, isn't it?
Well, here's the person talking all about mass or self-talk and stuff. And I do that. I do the exact same thing. I'm like, oh my God, I do that with tech.
Really?
Yeah, I do that with technology. And it's like, but that's a great little thing, isn't it? I don't know that yet.
Yeah.
And I do that myself because it's like, it's about having that growth mindset, because it's like, if you have that fixed mindset and you think you can't do anything, that your abilities and skills are innate and that's all you are. But it's this ability to learn that anything can be learned. So it's with tech, it's like, do I want to learn? I suppose you pick your battles as well, you know, that kind of a way. But it is, whatever it is, to be aware like that. People often say that about people have genius about them. They say genius is 10,000 hours of practice. It's consistency. It's about putting that action and showing up day after day. Like I often say, I hear a couple of people saying, you're really smart when I'm talking about certain topics like neuroscience. So it's not like I'm a pretty average IQ. I just put a lot of work into it. It's having that growth mindset and a willingness to work and knowing that if you put the practice in, you will get better at what you do. So I think that yet thing is a really golden nugget to throw in the end of any sentence.
Okay. But I would regard you as somebody who's very intelligent. Would you not see yourself that way yourself?
I wouldn't be let's say overly intelligent. Because when I was inside the psychology class, we were in with loads of young people and we'd done IQ tests and all, and there was some of them like super smart. Like what is intelligence? This is the big thing in psychology.
It.
Yeah. Now personally, so here I'm contradicting myself here. So if you talk about verbal intelligence, spatial intelligence, and the criteria that's normally measured, I'm a little bit above average. Me verbal intelligence actually a little bit below average, which I found interesting because I do a lot of writing, but a guy called Sternberg, who was a great psychologist, views intelligence as an ability to adapt. And I believe I have a very strong ability to adapt. So based on his criteria, I would say I'm very intelligent based on an ability to adapt.
Yeah.
But based on the average intelligence, I would be actually pretty average. But if I'm talking about neuroscience, if I'm talking about self-talk, if I'm talking about psychology, I'll come across way more intelligent. It's like that fundamental attribution error, it's called. It's like if someone's talking about the stuff, you attribute everything to them rather than the situation. Like, so if all of a sudden someone switched that and we start talking about botany, I wouldn't look so smart, you know? So it depends on the situation.
Yeah. So thinking back to what you were saying about being a kid, being a teenager, you know, and going down the road that you did, and you were craving this connection and this warmth, this love. Did you get it from friends? Did you get it from other people in your life? Or is the only place you got it through drugs?
True drugs, yeah. I didn't get it anywhere true life when I was in addiction, no. And I didn't look for it. I didn't look for it. I didn't look for it at all. It was just, it brought me on that journey. And I was even girlfriends that I had in the early years, I wasn't in any relationships as I got deeper into addiction. It was never about that for me. It was just all about the drugs. It was always about the drugs. I never even looked for that. And it just brought me deeper into that hole. So it was like, I didn't even know I had to look for it. It got that dark and that deep and that lonely. I remember talking to a psychologist that I'm doing a bit of work with at the moment. We're developing courses around addiction. And I was start saying I was like a lone wolf in thing. She says, you weren't a lone wolf, you were a lonely wolf. She says, no, I said, the drugs were the wolf. You were a lonely lamb. That's what you were.
Oh, yeah.
And I really put it into context for me. And even when I got clean, I still struggled with connection. Like, it's only in the last 2-3 years that I've really seen the power of that.
Okay.
Like, with my family, we've started to reconnect. We reconnected at that peripheral level very quickly. But now it's much more stronger at an emotional level. The book really helped me to see the harm I caused and apologizing to them and letting them know how much I hurt them as well. And then I've met someone before COVID-19, an amazing person, Natalie, came into my life, and it was just like, she'd be one of the most affectionate people ever. So it's like I'm making up for lost time, like, in other way. So it's has had a very happy ending, I have to say.
Yeah. I'm sure for your family, the because anyone I've spoken to who has written, you know, a memoir, something that is deeply personal, and it will impact.
Yeah.
The immediate family and those around them, because inevitably they will be in the story in one way or another. So I would imagine it was a healing process for you to write the book. I would imagine a very difficult process too. But did it bring about more connection and healing for your family members as well?
Yeah, 100%. They often say, it's a great line in addiction circles, that addiction is not a spectator sport. Eventually, the whole family gets to play.
Uh-huh.
But it's the same for recovery. Eventually, the whole family get to play. So I talked to my mom, like, for years now, we've talked about mindfulness and meditation. And she was into it before then, but we'd have great conversations about life and stuff like that. But it was still a little bit peripheral. In retrospect, we had a great relationship, but it was that peripheral relationship. But when I wrote the book and I realised the hurt I caused when I interviewed them, when I chatted to my mum about the, like, I brought my mum on a drug deal and put her in danger because I couldn't drive the car, and I put my sister in really bad danger when I was started selling drugs to fund my habit. So, and I knew I did these things intellectually, but I never felt their pain, or I never felt the guilt and the shame of that as well. So when I was writing the book, I really felt these things, but I still had a little bit of a shield. I think I was holding myself back, because I think if I really felt them things fully, I wouldn't have been able to cope. So there was a coping mechanism, sort of like a little drip, saying, feel that a little bit, but not too much. So, but it was a huge therapeutic experience for us, and we're so much closer today. After the book, recovery has brought us closer all the way. Every year we get closer and closer and closer. But writing that book, that big mammoth session, and really delving deep into that stuff, and the chats that I've had with them since, has brought us a lot closer. We've done a TV documentary as a family. It's going to be released in January as well. Yeah, it's on TG4, and the whole family are in there. And my brother at one stage actually says, like, he breaks down crying, and he says, like, he hasn't even apologized to us yet. So this is something I've been working on as well, because I apologize to some members of my family,
right?
But it's like, we didn't have them conversations, so I didn't actually do that, and I knew I had to do that. So it was fascinating that even up until a few months ago, I still hadn't crossed all them bridges.
And did you struggle with saying you were sorry?
Yeah, it's I had a huge conversation with my sister there a couple of months ago, and I think I didn't, I had the regrets and I was really sorry, but I didn't completely embody it, and I didn't feel I could say it. But it was only now that I feel like I'm so sorry, and I feel the sorrow so much now that I could say it with authenticity.
Yeah.
It was really strange, and I think it was a mix of us not having those conversations in the past. Like, I've gone and I can have deep conversations about with lots of people now because of that area. But when it comes back to the family, like, very little triggers me. It's very hard to trigger me. I'm pretty bulletproof to a lot of the external things. But me dad can do it in a flash.
Right.
Yeah, and it'd be great. He's a big teddy bear, but he says things. He's been a very negative person around Trump and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, God.
That's what they say about family members, isn't it? I always think of that Ram Dass quote.
It's lovely.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family.
Yeah. I was listening to your podcast with Mali.
Is that where I said it before as well? Yeah.
I hadn't heard it in years. It was amazing. So true.
But it's so true. No one can press your buttons like family members.
Yeah. So I think that
they know you so well.
They know you so well. And I think that was the difficulty of making that apology as well, and really getting them to understand that fully. But it's great. Things are really, really good in the whole family now, because there was addiction issues within my whole family. My younger brother, who was crying in the video, like, he was really upset with my addiction. He had his own addiction issues, but he's 2 years clean now.
Oh, wow.
So
brilliant.
Lots of great stuff have come from it.
So the domino effect.
Isn't that
fantastic?
Yeah, it's amazing.
So if it's not too personal to ask, is alcohol still a big player with your folks, or has that improved?
No, that's massively improved. So I would say, even before I got clean, me dad would have stopped drinking. So he would have been like a big drinker, session drinker. Like, he's openly talks about the stuff. So there's no problem about that.
Yeah.
Like, he'd go to pubs and he'd every day, and he'd be sitting in the pub all day playing the guitar, all the session gigs and stuff like that. So he'd done that for years. But that sort of just tapered off as he got older. And my mum would have still having a good few drinks and stuff like that, but she doesn't drink anymore either. Just sort of tapered off herself as well. But my sister, like, used to drink too much and wouldn't have a good relationship with alcohol. She doesn't drink anymore. My brother James is free 2 years now, hasn't had a drink in 2 years when he went to Rutland Centre. So everyone except me, my brother Calvin has a few drinks, but it'd be better if he didn't drink, but it's not as bad. But it's been a lot of healing around alcohol in the family.
Yeah, brilliant. Because, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with having a few drinks. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with that. Depending if it becomes an issue, then it needs to be looked at. And I do think for a lot of people this year, drink has been a comfort.
A crutch, yeah.
Yeah, and a crutch, absolutely. Yeah. That's a better word to use. I know for me this year, it's probably I found comfort in food and sweet things. I just probably eat more than I you know wanted to or should be consuming. But for other people, it's the glasses of wine or the beers or whatever, because it's been a tough all year.
Yeah.
And we're at home, and sometimes it can be just simply that people are a bit bored. But when it becomes something that is causing an issue in the waking hours, or something that you feel like you can't get through the week without, then maybe it needs to be looked at. Would you have any advice to anyone listening who is relying on drink or drugs a bit too much?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there around that. I think the realization is the awareness of why you're having that drink. There's always a trigger, and it could be environmental. It could be, I think, drug use or whatever, or alcohol use. It's avoiding feelings. You feel a bit anxious. You feel a bit stressed, and that's the reason for it. But what I would say is more tangible kind of help. If you're trying to stop drinking or you're trying to stop taking drugs, I think the first step is try to change your environment. So like, I love that line. Like, if you sit in a barbershop long enough, you'll end up getting a haircut. And it's so true. If you take junk food out of your house, it's unlikely you're going to eat it as well. Mm. If you take alcohol out of your fridge, you're not going to drink it as easily, especially now with the pubs being closed. So change your environment as much as you can. I think that's the first key thing. Because I would struggle with food as well. So I just make sure there's no junk food in the house, because I sort of, if it's one of the things I seem to give in to, I haven't got much resistance against food. I don't know why, when I have this huge resistance against alcohol and drugs. So I haven't figured that one out yet. So change your environment is the first thing. There's another great thing, like, to build awareness, like meditation practices is great. Observe your self-talk. Be aware of that inner critic. Like, if you're constantly berating yourself, be aware of the tone of that voice. Like, are you being stern? Are you being harsh on yourself? Because you're constantly criticizing yourself. That's going to have an impact on your body biologically, and anxiety will kick in. You'll want to escape that as well. But what I would say, if you're trying to give up and you're having these cravings, I think it's a great tool in addiction circles. It was part of my PhD. It's part of a course called Mindfulness Based Relapse Prevention. And there's an idea in it that a craving is a very strange energy in the body, but a craving only lasts about 60 to 90 minutes, 90 seconds. That's all a craving actually lasts.
That's short.
Yeah, it's a short time. And you could have a craving and say, I'd love a drink, but you could be hungry, you could be thirsty, you could be craving something else. But to get over that craving, there's a great mindfulness practice that's called surfing the urge. So literally think of that craving like a wave coming into the shore. And instead of just sort of giving into it, you just picture yourself surfing that urge and let it come in and surf the wave, ride the wave all the way into shore. And when that comes in, that craving will be gone. And you just have a glass of water and get onto something else. And you can do that with anything. Anger.
That's brilliant.
It's a great little technique.
I'm definitely going to try that one.
Yeah, it's a great little technique. You can use it with anything, not even just alcohol. Like, if you're going to be reactive, you're going to be angry and stuff like that. I was chatting to Mali about that.
Mm.
You surf the urge to lash out. You can use it in a lot of ways, because it's a craving to lash out. It's sort of a craving in a way as well.
Yeah, because oftentimes we're not responding. We're completely reactive, and before we know it, we've said things that we maybe didn't mean to say, or we've run away with ourselves.
Yeah,
and even the most evolved people, the most chilled out people, will sometimes, as you said, there'll be people that'll press their buttons, or there'll be stuff that they'll react to, and they'll find themselves going, how did that happen?
Yeah.
But the more, I suppose, you put these tools into practice, the better it can be. That's a brilliant, I love that one about the wave.
I'm definitely going to
work on that one.
And another one to add to that as well, I think it's the golden rule of changing habits as well, is like, you're trying to get rid of a bad habit, which is the alcohol. So replace it with a positive habit and reward yourself with it as well, because that's how you remove habits. You can't just extinguish something. It's very hard just to extinguish a bad habit and sit in a room and try to be not drinking. Like, reward it and do something good. Go for a walk, go for a run, do something with your friends, read a book, whatever that is, and reward yourself with that as well. I think that's important.
Do you ever have a moment where you feel a bit vulnerable or a bit weak, or you're just thinking back to that time when you know, taking heroin felt good? Does that ever creep into your mind anymore?
It's really interesting. So in 2015, I think it's important to say this. So I had that beautiful experience in 2013. It was like my whole world, I was just given this gift, dumb luck, when awakening, I don't know what to call it. It was this shift in perspective, and I was floating on a cloud. I went back to college, and in 2015, the second year of college, I wanted to really do well in college. I was really trying to compete and do well, and I was getting caught up in the busy world. I was back in the rat race. And I remember walking through Maynooth University and looking at the giant sequoia trees and just having this realisation, wow, I don't see them trees like I used to. I was like, I lost awareness in unawareness. And I was like, I lost that beautiful life feeling I was gifted and I didn't even see it. Now, previous to that, I was doing deliveries, field deliveries to finance myself, put myself through college. And I remember one of the evenings I had a bad cold and I went to the chemist and I says, I'm going to get Solpadin. I need Solpadin for this. Now, I was a heroin addict. I shouldn't be messing with Solpadin. Yeah. And I started taking Nurofen and Solpadin. Started regularly a couple of times a week playing around with that. So I literally had a relapse. Some people might see that as a big deal. In addiction circles, that's a huge deal. And I remember looking at them giant sequoia trees and it all came to me. Oh my God, like I'm losing that kind of edge that I had that. Whatever it was I was given, I was throwing it away. And that's when I dug down on my emotional and mental fitness. I developed what I call a program for life, the one that I follow and I share with everyone else. And ever since that day, I've never had a wobble. I used to often say that heroin, like I could sit in a room with people drinking, people doing coke, not that I would, but I could do that and it wouldn't bother me. I couldn't sit in a room with people doing heroin. And because it was just too powerful and I had too much of a pull on me. But since I've met Natalie, my girlfriend, and she often says that to me, and I says, no, I genuinely feel that it's not even a whisper in my ears anymore. It used to whisper to me, I think, from a distance. I'm over here if you ever need me. But it doesn't even whisper to me anymore. And I think I've completely extinguished that part of my life, and it's not a problem at all.
Yeah, but I suppose it's what you were saying, you know, the reason you were feeling anxious and the reason you turned to drugs and to heroin was that you were craving connection. Yeah. And now you have connection and abundance in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can we talk about Natalie?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yeah. So you're together now a few years?
No, we're only
not
together.
That long.
No, since February.
Oh, really?
Since February.
I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
So not even a year yet.
Not even a year yet. Yeah.
Okay. And it's going good.
It's going great. It's going really well, yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
I've never talked about this live before, but I'm open about it. She's cool about it too.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's going phenomenally well. And it's like when it was through COVID, so when we met, we couldn't actually.
Yeah,
through COVID. But I remember at one stage we had like an eight hour video call. And like I was like, the one problem we do have at the moment would be like I'm all about consistency and morning routines. I should be a bit more lax on that kind of stuff.
So
like,
you basically a whole day.
I went to bed at 9 o'clock all the time. That was my bedtime. 9 o'clock, up at 5 o'clock. Very rigid on this kind of stuff. And when I met her, what you call it, the first few texts, and I was like, I have to go. And she was like, oh, what are you doing that for? But then slowly and steadily, I was staying till 2, 3 in the morning. My whole routine was gone. 8 hour video calls. And it was just, we just really bonded over like spirituality, talking about emotions and the connection and every conversation out there. And we just bonded over that. And yeah, it's gone phenomenally well. It really is.
So in terms of your own feelings of spirituality and what feels right for you, what is that? What does that look like?
Yeah, so I wouldn't be religious in any way. For me, spirituality, I think, could be nearly the word awareness really slots in there. It's all about awareness for me. Now, I do believe there's an energy out there. Like it's like when you do talks, you can feel the energy in the room. You know when the energy is good. Now, we can't see electricity, but we know it's real. So why is energy not real? Like just because we can't measure it scientifically, and I'm a scientist, I'm doing the PhD, I'm doing all that stuff, but science can't explain everything. It's not the be all and end all. So just because you can't measure something doesn't mean it's not real. And I think energy for me is the currency of life. It is the currency of life.
Yeah.
And I protect me energy very in a big way. And I think for me that spirituality is just, there's an energy, a thing that we can't talk about. And when we, I don't know about karma or coming back or any of these things, but when our life does end in the body and all this kind of stuff, I think there's an energy that goes somewhere else. Like that for me is spirituality.
So the type of chats that you have, they can go to some deep places, I would imagine.
Very, very deep places. Yeah. And we bonded over with similar ideas on spirituality and energy and stuff like that. We've talked about dreams. She'd be big into the dream stuff. And we have our little arguments about not agreeing with this and not agreeing with that, which is healthy.
That's
as
healthy
well.
Too,
you
yeah.
know, it's very good. And yeah, they can just go anywhere. And just about feelings, like even though like here's the thing, it's when I'd never been in love before, ever. Never been in love before. And I didn't, not even close. And when I know that, because when we were having them calls, I remember just one evening after a call, and I remember just lying in my bed and I had this sort of weird feeling in my heart. was like, what the hell is that? Mm-hmm. And like, I didn't actually know what it was. Like this warm, pulling feeling. That was the first time I actually ever experienced it. I used to think when other people talked about that, they were exaggerating or I didn't really believe it. But I actually had that feeling in my chest, the physical feeling in my chest. And it's like, she'll love me talking about this now. But it was like, that was mind-blowing for me. So a lot of the conversations, I was just blown away by this. Like, oh my God, we're just talking about feelings 24/7. So it was like, I was like the female in the relationship really for a while. Like, yeah, you know, just all those feelings. Because I needed to go there because I'd hidden away from feelings for so long. So it was something I needed as well in my life.
Had you become disconnected from your own feelings, do you think, in the past?
Yeah, 100%. Completely disconnected. When I got clean and I was doing aftercare and in treatment, they'd say, well, how do you feel? And it was like, they might as well have been talking to me in French. I didn't know what, I'd intellectualise everything.
Okay.
Well, what are you talking about? And how does that work? And what's the information around feelings?
Like, trying to logically make sense of it.
Logically make sense of it. I didn't know feelings were in the body. And it was this mind-body disconnect because I couldn't go there, so I completely disconnected.
Yeah.
So over time, over the 5 years, I think I slowly began feeling the feelings very, very slowly. I didn't do this on purpose. It's just the way it all worked out for me. Mm. But I think that's what I had to do. I think there was a higher sense of awareness. The subconscious was saying, we're going to do this slowly because you're not going to be able to cope with all these feelings all at one go. So I think now that I'm ready, I've met Natalie at the right time. And like, it was like all of a sudden, I got addicted to feelings and I'm all about the feelings. But it was the timing was right.
So when did you go from your 8-hour video calls to actually seeing each other face to face?
Face to face. We seen each other, it would have been around April. So when the first thing was over,
we met
in the Phoenix Park and it was just a great first.
Was that surreal because you had been communicating online?
It was surreal because we knew each other so well.
Yeah.
Like that was one of many long video calls.
Sure.
We knew each other so well inside and out. And we've chatted about it and said, like, has it made the relationship a million times stronger? Because we knew so much about each other and we knew about our emotions, our spiritual life, our mental life before we got to know each other physically. So it's a very interesting thing. I want to write a blog on that, actually. I remember saying it to her, says we seen each other out in a club or something like that, we wouldn't have even talked to each other. Like, you wouldn't know, like, you know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah.
I'm delighted for you. This is great.
Thanks
so you're
that.
Like, this is, even though you've had a lot of challenges this year and obviously your book coming out was such a high moment for you, and then you had all this other stuff going around behind it, a launch not happening, the late not manifesting right now, it will. But this has been a brilliant time for you too.
It has. And it's funny, I don't like saying that out loud, but then I says, no, I have to own that. And you have to let people know that as well. The truth will speak for itself. And I think the truth will set you free. And I do genuinely believe that. So you have to tell people the truth and let them make their minds up on that as well. So I had huge challenges. My PhD was ruined as well during COVID because I was doing it in the Rutland Centre. And 2 years of work was just ruined in an instant because we hadn't got a big enough sample size. And if we continued... So if we continued measuring people, we'd be measuring baseline COVID anxiety rather than what's there.
So that meant that 2 years of work that you did is now scrapped.
Well, so I flipped it on its head and I've done a big, huge online study. So we did have to scrap that work, but I've still got the PhD. It's not going to affect
my
PhD.
Good.
I've nearly flipped it in a good way, which is a bit strange as well because I'm doing it based on another study that I've done for my master's and a lot of the same methodology, so I can copy a little bit of that for going forward for the thesis, which is nice. So it's made it easier for me in one way, and I don't plan to stay in academia as well, so it's turned out okay as well. But
don't plan on staying, why?
No, I don't. For me, I think there's a huge divide between academia and the real world. And I think I'm more about, academia is great and we need the knowledge, we need science, but I think it doesn't speak to the labor. It's not going to make the changes. Like I'll give you an example. Like one of the variables I'm studying in academia is called, it's impulsivity, but we call it response inhibition. There's another thing in self-talk in the science that I study around the behavior of language, really. And the unit of analysis is arbitrarily applicable relational respondent. Now, there's a reason for that within the science, but it just holds people back and it puts up these barriers. I think we need to be be more real.
I don't have a clue what you just said.
I know, it's crazy. But it's ready to be real. That's why I love the name of this show as well. Like, let's get real. Let's talk about the stuff that people can
break it down.
Actually relate to.
Yeah. But that's what you're brilliant at.
And I think, and that's why I'm going to get away from academia. So yeah. I'll keep my toe in there all the time. Like, I think I'll still lecture in Trinity and UCD because I love delivering them lectures on the neuroscience. But I deliver them lectures in a very lay way. It's a very an emotion-based lecture. It's story-based lecture. People can't sit for hours and hours and hours and listen to academic jargon. So I think in academia, yeah, we get it all just to tick a box. But like, if give them the information, but make it fun. Make academia fun. Tell them stories. Invoke emotions and make it fun so people can remember that and bring in the academic stuff as well. But I think there's a way of doing it as well. And I just don't think it's the right fit for me.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So what's on the list, the to-do list then, the future plans?
The to-do list, the big one for me, so obviously I'm starting my life sort of at 40, my financial life again. So as soon as I get myself financially stable, I'm doing loads of online courses. I have another book in me as well. I do a lot of speaking gigs. I'm doing a lot of consultancy work in the corporate arena as well around values and principles and culture and stuff like that. And it's going phenomenal at the moment. Like, I'm very, very lucky for that at the moment. But as soon as I get myself financially stable, or if I didn't have to worry about money right now, my big thing would be finding out the secret, the nugget of getting young people to engage in these tools.
Yes.
And that's the big one for me. And I'd love to go at a governmental level and say, like, really do a lot of research on that. How can we get them to engage? Because we teach them mindfulness. We get them to do this. We get them to do that. But how can we really get them to engage? And I think that's going to be a key thing. It's a big task. But that's my mission. That'd be one of my big missions.
Wow, brilliant. Okay, so you spoke about your morning routines. And I have signed up to do your course. I've already told you that this weekend I plan to sit down with a big mug of tea and the notepad and the pen and take notes. I'm so looking forward to it because I feel like my mornings need a lot of TLC. I'm the ultimate. Again, I'm not going to even verbalize what I was about to say because I'm reaffirming it. But in the past, I have been quite the procrastinator. So I'm looking forward to doing your course. But you said that you used to, before Natalie, was like, go to bed at 9, get up at 5. How does one do this?
You train yourself, and there's little tools and tactics for it as well. And I think that one of the biggest things, and it's a big part of my course, like, it's about morning routines and daily routines, but it's called the Mel Robbins rule, the 5-second rule. And I've dug deep into this rule, and it's grounded in science. And you literally just, if you're to do anything and you're feeling like you're about to negotiate, you say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. It has to be a backward countdown. And she done this herself in her own experience, and she completely changed her life. And she's used this now and delved into the science of this, and it's grounded in locus of like science stuff like locus of control, behavioral activation, lots of other scientific principles. And it basically doesn't give your brain the ability to start the negotiations, to justify and to rationalize, and to stop you doing what you want to do. So
the second you're maybe like picking up the phone to, you know, look at something on Instagram, you go into the countdown.
Yeah, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go, and put it
down.
Yeah.
I like that.
As soon as you wake up in the morning, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And you have to go. Now, there's a great idea as well. I love Jerry Seinfeld come up with this idea of don't break the chain. So if for 22 years, I think it was, he told at least one joke for 23 years because he didn't break the chain, at least something, he'd done a bit of work on it. So I done that with my morning routine a couple of years ago, and I never break the chain. So even if I wake up and I'm mad late, let's say, to do something, I'd say, right, well, I'm going to do 30 seconds of gratitude because I don't break the chain. So I'll wake up and I'll say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. But what happened with me was I didn't break the chain with 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. So every time I thought of that, I jumped into action. So I'd nearly think of something that I had to do, and I'd be like, oh my God, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I have to do it. I was like, oh my God, I have to do it, but I'd done it. So it became an action habit, and it came through practice in my life as well. So they're very powerful techniques. I go into a lot more depth and detail within the course, obviously, as well. But it's about building them habits, and it's motivation is another thing. Motivation is a myth. Like, we think we're not motivated, but if you weren't motivated to go for a run and I put a line in front of you, all of a sudden you're motivated. So the environment determines your motivation. Like, that's a really important player as well to realize. If you're not feeling motivated, you just haven't set up your environment the right way.
Yeah.
So if you want to get motivated for a morning routine, set up your morning in the day. Like, set your alarms a certain way, put your phone in the next room so you have to get up out of bed, use the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 rule. But then don't make it really difficult for yourself. Like, don't start with a morning routine that takes you an hour. Do a minute of gratitude, a minute of visualization. That's a 2-minute practice. Make it easy. and you're putting less obstacles in the way.
Yeah, because again, Mally, who we spoke about there, the chat that we had, she spoke about your habit stacking.
Yes.
So it's effectively that, isn't it? And you build and you build and you build. And the more you do it, the more it embeds in and it gets easier to do it. And you automatically, I suppose it's like muscle memory, isn't it?
It's like muscle memory. And the idea with habit stacking, which is really brilliant. So it's creating a new habit and stacking on an existing habit. Mm. So we all washed our hands throughout COVID. So I start telling people, well, mindfully wash your hands. So what I was doing it myself. So now every time I wash my hands, I find myself doing it mindfully because I've stacked those habits together. They're associated.
Yeah.
Brushing your teeth. We all brush our teeth. So mindfully brush your teeth. Have a first cup of coffee in at the start of the day. Have a mindful cup of coffee where you're drinking and you're really feeling, you're really being present. And you will just make them associations and you will do that automatically as well. So try to make it as easy for yourself as you can. And that's the key piece.
So are you back to waking up at 5 now again?
No, I don't think I'll ever get back. I'm not allowed. Well, I'm not allowed to go to bed at 9.
So how early is early now?
7 is the thing. And see,
that's far more doable for me. 7 is my uptime. Yeah, so, yay.
I used to be in the gym for 6. I was in the National Aquatic Centre and we had a great social group in that gym. And we used to have great laughs. But God knows when the gyms are going to open back up. But I've set up my own gym circuit now at home as well. And I have it all working for me. So I'll probably just stick with the I'm not allowed to go back to let's be honest.
Come here. I've loved this chat, and I know we've only scratched the surface, and you're going to continue to plan programs and talks and as you said, really implement that and communicate with our younger generation, which is so important.
Oh, they need it.
And especially now, because we all know that during this time, the age group that's really been impacted is the late teens, early 20s. Yeah. They really need help, you know.
Yeah.
More power to you, Brian. It's been so good to meet you in person. And I know you have a huge fan base and it's going to continue to grow and grow and grow. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a million.
It's been great meeting you, Sheila. I remember when I was at Pendulum, it was the last Pendulum, and I seen you talk and it was just the vibe you had. I have to talk to Sheila Shoga someday. And
I'm just delighted
to come in here and have the chat. It's been fantastic.
It's been an honour. Cheers, man. Thanks a million.
Thanks, lad. Thank you.
If you're interested in joining any of Brian's brilliant online courses, simply go to his website, brianpenny.com. And if you enjoyed our conversation, please show your support by clicking follow, giving a rating and leaving a little comment. Thank you so much. This episode of Ready to Be Real Conversations was brought to you in partnership with Dr. Coy's, who offer tasty, nutritional chocolate and a range of free-from cooking ingredients.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.